Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht, and I'm here with Professor John Givens, who's written a book, The Image of Christ in Russian Literature, where he's covering Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Bulgakov, and Pasternak. So thank you for being with us, John.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation and for your interest in my book.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting book, I think. So I was wondering at the beginning here, could you start us off by telling us a bit about yourself, how you got interested in Russian literature, where you went to school, who you studied with, and so on?
Sure. A brief biography would have to include the fact that I was an indifferent language student who went to his local college, the University of Oregon, on a journalism scholarship. So I came in on a journalism scholarship and went out as a Russian major between 1980 and 1985, breaking my mom's heart because she knew what a journalism major would do with a degree, but she had no idea what a Russian major was going to do with a degree back then. You either spy or you teach, and I ended up getting into teaching almost by accident, really. But I got into the University of Oregon. They had a fantastic Russian program. The only reason I stumbled into it is because my undergraduate advisor was a Russian history professor who, when he asked me, what language are you going to study, because we've got a language requirement. And I told him, well, you know, I'm not really interested, in the traditional European languages. He said, well, why not Russian? And so I took Russian, but in the first couple of weeks, as you know, it's tough sledding at first, and wanted to drop. And I was kind of a naive kid back then, so I went into my Russian professor, a wonderful guy, Jim Rice, now since passed, University of Oregon, and he did what all Russian professors do when a first-year Russian student comes to them to tell them that they're going to drop the class. He lied. He told me, you have great Russian, John. You're going to be wonderful. You should stick around. And I felt so guilty. I stayed in the class. And what he then did is every day he'd come and he'd start the class off with a Russian question to me. And that's how he really instilled in me both a fear and a love of Russian.
Fear and love. That's it's very Machiavellian, come to think of it.
So what happened then is, you know, as what happens with all of us when we finally do get into Russian, you get rather carried away with it. I said, this is fantastic. I went to the Soviet Union in 1984 for a four-month program at the Pushkin Institute, came back, had this great desire to teach Russian, went to a two-year terminal master's degree thinking I was just going to get some teaching credentials and get out there and teach Russian. So I went from University of Oregon to University of California, Davis, where they had a nice little two-year teaching program. And there I met a couple of wonderful professors, Daniel Rancourt LaFerriere, who was a full professor there, and a visitor from Berkeley, Galia Dement, who was a ABD dissertation, PhD candidate. And the two of them instilled in me a great love of an interest in literary analysis. And so I decided, you know what, I think I'm going to try another degree. And for reasons I won't entirely disclose here, I ended up at the University of Washington for my PhD, where actually I was able to bring Galia Dement up as a new hire. I was the graduate student on the search committee that brought her there, and because I really wanted to work with this woman. She became my dissertation advisor in Washington, and so it is in this way that it turns out that I now have a degree in every state on the West Coast.
That's a very unusual. Usually we go to the professors rather than the reverse.
That's the strange thing. Now, I went to University of Washington. There were wonderful people to work with there. But when the position came up, and I thought, well, I know exactly who would make a perfect addition to the faculty here. So you're absolutely right. This is a totally random and kind of a haphazard introduction to Russian, but kind of fatalistic at the same time.
Well, that is a good story. So, you're covering in the book kind of four of the big greats of Russian literature: Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Bulgakov, and Pasternak. Maybe again for the uninitiated, everybody's heard of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, but maybe in the United States or the West in general, Bulgakov in particular would probably be the least, familiar up front. So I was wondering if you could just maybe riff for a few minutes on what it is that makes these four authors such key parts of the canon.
Absolutely. So when you decide at some point in your career that maybe you're going to write a book on the image of Christ in Russian literature, the first thing you discover is that you are facing an impossible bibliographic demand. There's so much out there just on Christ alone, on Christology, on various schools of thought about both historical, theological, about who this man was. That you realize, especially if you weren't trained in these areas, that you're going to have a lot of upfront research to do. And I knew that to write a book called The Image of Christ in Russian Literature, I would have to somehow narrow the field so that the book could be written. It's one thing just getting up to speed on what theologians and scholars are saying about Jesus Christ. It's another thing to look at the 200 plus years of what we'd consider contemporary Russian literature that is dating from Pushkin to the present day, and cover all of that territory, looking for references to Christ and ideas about how this person is imaged in literature. So I decided I would stick with the four authors whose work most prominently attempts to image Christ. So in the 19th century, certainly Dostoevsky, we all know that his novels are permeated with a Christian ethos and that Jesus Christ was a very important person to him personally. And so there's no surprise that Dostoevsky should be in a book like this. Tolstoy, again, everyone knows that Tolstoy, shortly after Anna Karenina, had a bit of a what many people call a religious conversion, kind of an unorthodox one, though, in which he suddenly realized after writing these two great masterpieces that there wasn't anything left for him to accomplish. And the only thing that was before him was his eventual death. And how was he going to make sense of that? So he turned to his own native Orthodox religion to look for answers to this riddle of life and death. And discovered two things: that the Russian Orthodox Church, its doctrines and dogmas and its rituals, left him cold and indifferent, but that the teachings of Jesus Christ inflamed in him a great desire to live according to the precepts of this great teacher. Something that he, by the way, knew as early as 1854-55, in a diary entry, he talks about wanting to create a new kind of religion based on Christ's teachings, but not on anything supernatural, something more earthly, bringing happiness here and now. So Tolstoy becomes an interesting person because his interest in Christ is a negative one. He says that Jesus was not the Son of God. He is not divine. His teachings are, and it is by these teachings that we can live and attain to a higher spiritual life with God. So he has to be in there, and he's a great offset to Dostoevsky, who argues the exact opposite. We need Christ, in particular, the grace of Jesus Christ, in order to fulfill those hard and lofty demands that Tolstoy so admired in Jesus' teachings. So those two, those two naturally fit the scope of the book, and they you could write a book just about their grappling with the image of Christ. But I wanted to, again, there's no volume in the West, no English language volume on the image of Christ in Russian literature. So I wanted to write a book that, if there was going to be just one, it could be this one. It was going to give you a broad enough look at the question of how Russian literature images Christ, but it would still be somehow reined in so that it could be finished and not be a multi-volume 3,000 page tome that no one would end up reading. So I said these guys will speak for the 19th century. And I knew as well from teaching contemporary literature or 20th century Soviet literature to my students here at University of Rochester that there were two other authors who had conspicuously incorporated images or interesting imagings of Jesus Christ in their work, and that would be the playwright and novelist Mikhail Bulgakov. The poet and novelist Boris Pasternak, who knew each other, met with each other. Pasternak actually visited Bulgakov at his in his final days. They had a private conversation. No one knows what they said. It'd be intriguing because by then Bulgakov had finished the one novel that is featured in my book, and that is the novel that everyone remembers Bulgakov for, a novel called The Master and Margarita. That contains an inserted alternate gospel, if you will, four long ornate chapters on a person who looks like Jesus Christ, but he's been renamed and reconfigured. He's Yeshua Ganotsri, and he, in these four chapters, inserted in this larger narrative about the devil's visit to Stalin's Russia in the 1930s, this alternate Christ challenges our notions, our preconceptions of the gospel Jesus. So I knew that Bulgakov had to be in here. Now, Bulgakov, very well known in Russia, of course, less known outside of Russia, except for this novel. He was a satirist, a playwright, and unfortunately, like many of the great novelists, died relatively young at 48 of nephrosclerosis, the same disease that took his father. And he just barely finished this, his sunset novel, The Master and Margarita, before his death. In fact, he never fully corrected part two of the novel, so there are some textual inconsistencies and whatnot in that text that I address in my book that are part of my analysis, and I think reveal some aspects of his approach to the question of who is Jesus Christ and why am I writing this totally reconfigured, almost secular Jesus in his place in my inserted novel, in this novel, Master and Margarita. So Mikhail Bulgakov gets there, and frankly, if a listener out there has not ever heard of him, one visit to a bookstore and a purchase of Master Margarita will do the usual trick, which is to convince the reader who has never heard of Bulgakov that he's one of the great novelists of the 20th century. And my final case study, Boris Pasternak, a Silver Age poet, very, very complex poetry, very complex early prose throughout the 1930s, a leading figure in the Soviet literary establishment, of one of those writers who managed to survive Stalin's repression, Stalin's time, intact and alive, surviving by publishing translations at times. He has an interesting story. He is Jewish by ethnicity and creed, but his parents were non-practicing and were just fine with the family nanny taking young buddies out to be baptized, Orthodox. And we're fine with her even bringing him to some of the divine liturgies. And so as a young boy, Pasternak grows up in this milieu of the liturgy of the church in the times right before the revolution sort of makes church attendance not so possible. And but this is a formative moment for him, and so he has this sense of himself as this unique individual somewhere between Judaism and Christianity, fully conceived, and carries that with him through his adult years until the war comes, and the privations and hardships of the war bring on some reforms from Stalin. He allows church attendance again. He brings the church hierarchy out publicly to endorse the national effort against the Nazis and so on and so forth. And partly because of this, Pasternak reacquaints himself with the religiosity of his childhood and his early adult years, and rediscovers this this Christianity, this idiosyncratic Christianity. And he writes this novel meant to be a broad canvas of his times, of how Russia moved from the imperial period into the early Bolshevik and Soviet state. So he writes this narrative that concludes around 1929, 1928, somewhere in there, right when Stalin is just consolidating power. And it's about this doctor poet who writes, and we find out in the appendix to the book, it's actually not even an appendix, it's called Part 17, a series of poems, fully a third of which are poems about Jesus Christ. And they're actually very traditional biblical poems. And we start to understand that this character, Dr. Zhivago, has himself many Christ-like attributes, as in, and is himself a kind of Christ figure, though a very unorthodox one. So the Mr. Margarita and Dr. Zhivago are the great Eastern novels of the 20th century, had to be in the book, and of course Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, the great novelists of Russian literature in general, but also the two greatest novelists to grapple with the image of Jesus Christ. That explains how the four of them got into the book. It also explains a little bit why these four are sufficient to give us a sense for Russian literature's encounter with Christ over those two centuries. I have a little bit in the book at the end about post-Stalin, post-modernist imagings of Christ. And I have a couple of background chapters in the book to give people some, again, specialists would know all this stuff, but some information, social, historical, theological, that is necessary to understand other issues in the book.
So another kind of general point of clarification then would be if you could explain what it means to read a text apophatically. That's a concept that a lot of people might not be familiar with.
Right. So it's interesting. So apophaticism is a theological approach to God that is more prominent in the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church, than in the Western, although it's here in the Western Church as well. In the Eastern Church, sort of grabs onto this notion of this approach to apophaticism that comes from the 5th century Christian theologian Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, who as early as then understands that this, and I'll just quote briefly from one of his central writings on this, that the supreme cause of every conceptual thing, that is God, is not itself conceptual. So Pseudo-Dionysius says that the only way we can really know God is to sort of unknow what we think we know about God. That is, that the apophatic approach that he discovers is his apophatic theological approach, is an approach that says we have to empty ourselves of all concepts of God and even all conceptual language, because God is beyond concepts and God is beyond conceptual language. We can't even begin to form thoughts about God. And so we have to empty ourselves. To do so, you engage in a litany of describing things which God is not. God is not this. God is not that. And in fact, he gives us a little list. He goes on for quite a while. I'll give you a little bit. He says, God is not kingship. It is not wisdom. It is neither one nor oneness, divinity nor goodness, nor is it a spirit in the sense in which we understand that term. It is not sonship or fatherhood, and it is nothing known to us or to any other being. There is no speaking of it, nor name nor knowledge of it. Darkness and light, error and truth, it is none of these. It is beyond assertion and denial. So he's even saying that, look, even when we engage in the apophatic approach, denying, you know, sort of saying what God is not, we're still not getting there. Eventually, you have to get yourself to a place of utter and complete darkness and ignorance. And maybe there you might, in a moment of sort of transrational, ecstatic union, you might encounter God. Now, apophaticism permeates Russian monasticism of the 19th century with its reliance on approaches to God that eschew this sort of concept formation. So as one Dostoevsky scholar Malcolm Jones says, it's in the very air that these 19th century writers are breathing. They know about this approach to the Godhead. So some Dostoevsky scholars in particular in the last 20 years have sort of used apophatic concepts to get at some of the things that Dostoevsky is doing in his novels. And as I'm looking at the novelists that I'm dealing with, I'm looking at novelists who each of them in their own way produces very unorthodox images of Christ. In fact, even negative images of Christ. I mean, think of Tolstoy utterly negating the divine qualities of Christ. And I'm thinking there's something here that unites the four case studies and that is uniquely Russian, that to know the Godhead, to know Christ as Son of God, as God, is to somehow say what he is not. And to add to this, I was looking at the tension that starts to really build in the 19th century as secularism makes such inroads into Russian intellectual life because of the growth of the historical critical method of biblical studies. So it says that, hey, we can look at the Bible in a more rationalistic, scholarly manner. And when we do, we start to discover that maybe this Jesus Christ is just one of those itinerant philosophers, of which there were so many back in first century Judea. All this secularism starts to make its inroads into Russian intellectual culture. And so both Dostoevsky and Tolstoy are saying, okay, how are we going to talk about Christ to a society becoming increasingly secular? And to my mind, they do so from a negative vantage point, not through some sort of apologetics, but by saying, here, I'm going to give you a Christ that you don't expect and see if you recognize Christ somehow if I do so. And that's sort of the departure point for the book. And certainly you can see that in the 20th century, we've got two authors who are writing in an officially atheist state. So even, I guess the impulse there is even more so. They know they can't really affirm Christ. So what can we do? Well, let's maybe do something that's less affirmative, but more revelatory and maybe even publishable at some point in Soviet times.
So in light of that, you know, way of thinking about your approach to these books, then, what would you regard as, say, the, you know, a key scene from Demons and the Brothers Karamazov that really kind of illustrate, you know, in sum total how Dostoevsky's approaching Jesus backwards in that fashion?
Well, you know, it all sort of starts with a letter that he writes to this wife of a Decembrist who had, when he was on his way to 4 years of hard labor in Siberia for his participation in a radical the radical Petrushevsky circle as a young man. She's a wife of a Decembrist rebel who had been exiled already earlier in the very first year of Nicholas I's reign for proposing that there be a constitutional monarchy. She and all these other wives of the Decembrists, they followed their husbands into exile, those who weren't hanged. And so she gives Dostoevsky a Bible on his way to prison, which is the one piece of literature you can have in prison, and slips a 25 ruble bill or something like that in the spine for him to use in prison. And so when he gets out of prison, he writes her a letter, and in it he talks to her about his faith. And I'll quote partly from it because it sets up why I decide that Dostoevsky comes dangerously close to giving us a Christ who is not the Christ he thinks he's giving us. He's giving us a Christ who may be even not divine. And it points to a methodology in his works where all of a sudden he seems to be spending more time about giving us reasons why we should not believe in the biblical Christ than maybe we should believe. So this sets up my comment I'm going to make on the Brothers Karamazov. In this March 1854 letter, he tells Natalia von Wiesiewna, "I am a child of this century, a child of doubt and disbelief. I have been and shall ever be, that I know, until they close the lid of my coffin." Now, at the same time, though, he points out that he has a potent symbol of faith in his life in which all is clear and sacred. He says, "This symbol is very simple, and here is what it is. To believe that there is nothing more beautiful, more profound, more sympathetic, more reasonable, more courageous, and more perfect than Christ." Now, if he left it there, he'd be fine. But he's Dostoevsky, so he can't. He has to always go on and on. He exaggerates. He has this hyperbolic streak. And there not only isn't, but I tell myself with a jealous love, there cannot be. Again, if he stopped here, he'd be fine. More than that, if someone succeeded in proving to me that Christ was outside the truth, again, if he stopped, he might still be okay. And if indeed the truth was outside Christ, I would sooner remain with Christ than with the truth. Now, what did Dostoevsky just do here? This is well before he starts on the great, you know, metaphysical novels of his mature period. He's just indicated that even if you say, prove that Christ is not the Son of God, is not divine, that there maybe is no God, he's going to stick with Christ no matter what. So what is this? This is not really entirely an affirmation of faith, is it? Because it's a faith in what? If there's no God, what are you going to have faith in? You're going to have faith, he says, in this Christ outside the truth. Well, Christ outside the truth becomes a very problematic moment in Demons, because there you have a character like Shatov, who is ecstatic about this sort of Russian messianic Christ, but doesn't believe in God. And so you wonder, well, this is indeed the Christ outside the truth that Dostoevsky's telling us about. If there's no God, then how? Then the Christ that Shatov believes in is not divine. This is a Christ outside the truth. But where does it lead? It leads to all the chaos and destruction associated with Dostoevsky's depiction of the revolutionary, the radical materialists that terrorize a small provincial town in his novel. But it also alerts us to the fact that Dostoevsky seems to allow, here in this letter and in his mature novels, for both outcomes, for both belief and unbelief. And in his later novels, when these are the 1860s, when materialism is made, secularism has made such inroads into Russian intellectual life, educated society. He feels by then that maybe an earnest, outright defense of Christ is no longer possible, and so he kind of goes back to this idea as well. Maybe I can conjure belief out of unbelief, and so to me, and I think many would agree with me, many of his novels are really give us more reasons not to believe than to believe. But he's doing so with a very an angle in mind here. He's doing so to show us, well, this is how unbelief might suddenly reveal belief. And indeed, in Demons, There's the great censored chapter at Tikhon's where we have Stavrogin, the hero of demons, meeting with this Orthodox priest who tells him that the most fervent atheist actually stands on the next to last step to the most complete faith. And this sort of reveals Dostoevsky's program, as it were. But it works in both directions. And this is where I get to Brothers Karamazov. A lot of people think that Brothers Karamazov is Dostoevsky's most eloquent pronouncement on the need to believe and the need for Christ. And indeed, in many ways it is. But it is also his most profound exploration of unbelief in the character of Ivan Karamazov. And what an apophatic analysis reveals in that novel is that that one of the things that Dostoevsky seems most fervently trying to do is not so much make an apologetics for faith, say through the chapters on Father Zosima, the sort of the writings of Father Zosima that Alyosha puts together and that we read as in the novel, but rather the most convincing and interesting affirmation of faith happens in the journey of Ivan Karamazov, his journey into unbelief, and his different theological propositions, which all reveal a moment that can suddenly turn his unbelief into belief if he but allows it. So to give you just one example, by the time he gets done reciting his poem of the Grand Inquisitor, which is a great, devastating critique of why Christ's teachings fail us in the real world, his brother, to whom he's reciting this, the pious Alyosha, who himself confesses maybe he doesn't believe in God, suddenly exclaims the first thing he says when Ivan is done. He says, "But your poem praises Jesus; it doesn't revile him." And I thought that's a strange moment, and no one really talks about that in the criticism. I mean, they mention that they say, "Well, maybe Alyosha is talking about the fact that the poem of the Grand Inquisitor is so critical of Christ because he criticizes how Christ gives us all this radical freedom. And we can't handle radical freedom." But in essence, actually, there's an apophatic operation as well in which we can say that what Ivan is doing with his depiction of Christ in the Grand Inquisitor is actually saying to us what Christ is not, so that, like Alyosha, we suddenly exclaim, but that's not what Christ is. And in saying what he's not, you're actually praising what he is. And for me, that apophatic moment is present in other areas of both Brothers Karamazov and in other novels by Dostoevsky. So that's how I take this theological concept and I turn it into a bit of a literary method. And I'm not saying that these writers are engaging in the kind of theological exercise one would do if one were practicing an apophatic approach to finding the Godhead, so much as saying that these writers all seem to be giving us distorted, negative, unexpected imagings of Christ, with the idea that perhaps only then we can maybe realize or understand what Christ must be. And they leave it all, even Dostoevsky, rather open for us to decide who that Christ ultimately is. There's nothing dogmatic about any of these four writers' depictions of Christ, even Dostoevsky's, who, though he said he was going to write Brothers Karamazov as a vindication of orthodoxy, ended up really writing a rather unorthodox novel. And he himself wasn't a great attender of divine liturgy. So here's where we get to an interesting moment for all of our writers, revealing through negation.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So is that why then? I'm going to hazard a thesis here that at the end of the great conversation between Alyosha and Ivan at the cafe, then is that why that conversation simply ends with the kiss, where God or where Alyosha, if he said anything, that would be too positive an affirmation of God. So by not saying anything and just kissing his brother, that's kind of apophatic in its own way.
Well, it is in a sense. What Alyosha does is he plagiarizes from the conclusion of his brother's poem. Alyosha asks him, well, how did things end up? And Ivan tells him, well, Christ, who, by the way, is forbidden from saying anything because he cannot add to the fund of revelation already given to humankind until his second coming. And this apparently isn't his second coming. So he remains silent throughout the whole interview. The only response he makes to the Grand Inquisitor is he reaches over and kisses the Grand Inquisitor. Alyosha does the same thing, and Ivan chides him for his plagiarism. But the point is exactly that. It's a kind of a non-response. It's a kind of an open-ended affirmation of a negation, as it were, and a sign that maybe the negation has caused a revelation that might be one of faith. And thus Dostoevsky leaves that open. He always left the question of faith open. He never, in his novels, no matter how much Nabokov says he does, he's never forcing on us a kind of a proselytizing literature. All of his novels are entirely open-ended, and maybe of them all, Brothers Karamazov most of all. I mean, here we have a novel where at the end, we don't even know whether Dmitri Karamazov is really going to follow through on his great mission to suffer for the innocent baby he sees suffering in his dreams. I'll go and suffer for all the innocents out there. Or whether he's going to escape. There's this crazy escape plan that's been hatched that his brother Alyosha no less is involved in. Is he going to escape? Is he going to suffer for the wee one? Is Alyosha, he's been told by his elder to go out into the world, will he lose his faith? He's already confessed he might not believe in God. Will Ivan come out of his brain fever? We don't even know that at the end of the novel. And if he does, will he be a believer or not? Dostoevsky leaves all of this open because he doesn't want to prescribe conversions for us. He wants us to take these negative reflections, if you will, and see if they reveal something. He takes unbelief and says, here's unbelief. What does it conjure up for you? In terms of belief, it's a neat moment.
Yeah, I certainly have pondered that scene for many years, so I was curious to ask you about it. So on the subject of Tolstoy, then something that occurred to me when I was reading your book was I was thinking back to whenever I read War and Peace last, and how Tolstoy is so skeptical of people who claim to know all the answers, all the ridiculous generals who think they're controlling events, but really they don't, and so on. And so it occurred to me when I was reading your book that where you're pointing out how Tolstoy accepts Christ's teaching and rejects Christ himself, occurred to me that Tolstoy has really high confidence in his own powers of reason here, that he can just outright say, well, Christ's teaching was correct, but Christ himself wasn't divine at all. And I don't know, is there a tension here what makes Tolstoy so certain when in something like War and Peace, it seems to me like he's profoundly uncertain about the world he lives in.
Well, the funny thing about War and Peace is that there is that discourse in the novel, but at the same time, throughout the novel, he's slowly building up his own theory of history. And by the time you get to the midpoint of the novel, the novel's form starts to shift, and more there'll be these brief introductions to the part that is going to unfold that are sort of just pronouncements from the narrator himself state the next formulation in Tolstoy's theory of history. And so by the end of the novel, you have this whole Tolstoy counter-narrative to traditional historical discourse that he then, feeling insecure that we might not have properly noticed all of this as we were reading this long novel, he decides he's going to have an epilogue. There are two epilogues. The first one is a traditional epilogue where we visit the characters 10 years or so down the road and see what happened to them. And then there's this other epilogue, another 50 to, depending on your translation, to 75 pages, where he goes through and restates this whole theory of history in no uncertain terms. This is what history must be. It's a history that reveals to us a greater dependence on outside causes and a far less degree of volition and personal freedom than we imagine. He ends the novel on a very declarative and authoritative, if not authoritarian, note. So when you get to that part of War and Peace, you've kind of been whiplashed because he's been using his argument about you can't know what's going on in a battle. You can't know the course of history. Because of all these miniature factors that can change anything. But then he builds this into a theory of history that is very declarative and very, very much saying this is how history really works. And it sort of goes against the spirit, as you say, of what he's been preaching earlier. So really, it's not surprising that by the time he gets to his so-called conversion period, that he declares these teachings of Christ are the best things best way you can actually not only find happiness, but find union with God. And moreover, what does he do? He seizes on the five most difficult pronouncements, sort of the new commandments from the sermon on the mount or the sermon on the plain. And he says these five things are actually quite doable. And, they're really not. This is where Christ says things like, you were told, do not murder. Well, anyone can go through a day not murdering somebody. I'm going to tell you, if you are even angry with somebody, you've committed murder. There, how do you like that? And so Christ goes through all of these things. He says, you were told do not commit adultery. I say, if you even lust, you commit adultery. Swearing oaths is lying because no one can really keep their word. You were told you have to resist evil. I'm telling you not to resist evil. If someone says to you, give me your cloak, well, you have to give them your tunic as well. And the most importantly of all, Christ says, love those who hate you. So these five sort of unfulfillable commandments become for Tolstoy the most reasonable things in the world that if we just put our minds to, we can achieve. And once we achieve it, we've got paradise on earth just as he wanted back in his 1855. Diary entry. So you see, he's first of all not at all shy about saying, you see, this is it. I know that these Christian teachings are the most important. You'll be happy if you just follow them. And moreover, you think these are unreasonable? They're not at all. You just need to do them, and then you'll be happy. Whereas Dostoevsky would look at that and say, you can't do those five things unless you had the grace of Christ. And that's where those two differ. But that's Tolstoy. I mean, that kind of authoritative language is there throughout his entire career, and it really comes out in this post-conversion period.
So what, given Tolstoy's own kind of, I guess I see it as kind of a tragic end anyway, does that high confidence you're talking about, does it ever look to you like he was kind of shaken in that at any point?
I don't think he was, but I do think he was, um, he he painted himself into a corner, because as soon as he comes up with this thing that he dreamed about doing in 1855 in his diary entry, he suddenly realizes that he's become the new prophet, and there are pilgrims coming to Yasnaya Polyana, his estate, to see him, and he's corresponding with Mahatma Gandhi, and he's become this world figure. And he's actually become that person in War and Peace that he criticizes the most. He says that the Tsars and the Napoleons of the world are the least free of us all, because they are sort of highest on this pyramid of scale where their actions are most determined by those around them. Leaders simply reflect in that way what all the causes and the different people around them, you know, sort of lead them to promote. That's what happened to Tolstoy himself. By the end of his life, he was rather paralyzed, I think, turned himself into this new prophet for a different kind of Christianity. So maybe that flight from Yasnaya Polyana wasn't so much just from his wife and the intolerable family situation that he was struggling with for so long, but even a flight from this sense of being hemmed in that he might have felt at this point, being a new prophet of Christianity.
A bit like Christ fleeing into the wilderness, come to think of it.
Yeah, to get away from all of this press of expectations.
So, we're kind of moving into the Bolshevik era then. You talked about something that I'm guessing most people aren't going to be familiar with, and that's the God Builders movement. And I was thinking here, I don't know if you've read Yuri Slozkin's book, House of Government or not, where he's talking about Bolshevism as a millenarian cult.
I have not read that book. It's a fantastic looking book, though.
Oh, it's incredible.
Quite the saga. I mean, it's something under 1,000 pages or so.
Yeah, well, and it's not too subtly kind of a play on Tolstoy's vision. You know, there's a great line at the beginning where he says, "This is a work of history. Any resemblance to fictional characters is purely coincidental." You know, it's a fantastic book. And anyway, I thought maybe it would be helpful for folks if you talk for a bit about this kind of early, really radical phase in Bolshevism that because we're used to hearing about the atheist state and so on. Where how does this God Builders movement play into that?
Well, so the God Builders are sort of a reaction to the God Seekers. The God Seekers were a group that Dmitry Mieroshkovsky forms and his wife, Zinaida Gipius, in the teens. There were all sorts of religious societies and such forming. There was a sense of apocalypse in the air at the fin de siècle of the 19th century and into the 20th century. There was this idea that there was a great cosmic retribution that was going to be visited upon Russia, and more specifically, that somehow it was going to come from Asia. And there were three significant poems that all talk about this in terms of an Asian invasion, much like the Mongol invasion. The God Builders is sort of a reaction to that, because it starts to develop again in the teens. People like Alexander Bogdanov and Anatoly Lunacharsky, who later becomes the first Commissar of Enlightenment in the young Bolshevik state, they are people who are responding to this impulse of a combination of a religious impulse and a Promethean impulse to make of the revolution something quasi-religious, even well, mystical, I would say, more than quasi-religious. It becomes a bit of a religion later on, as I discuss in the book, and as everyone can see looking at the Soviet state. But it's not surprising that there should be this impulse. See, what Lunacharsky and all of those God Builders were after is to capture some of that idealism that was generated, that religion generates, and that settles around the image or the figure of Jesus Christ himself. As a matter of fact, Lunacharsky called Jesus this unique leader of the proletarian masses of Galilee, you know, a proletarian hero, a teacher of great love and also of great hatred. And in so doing, he actually reveals that that this idea that secularism is a result of atheism is a little misguided. Secularism also arises when you realize that people like Jesus Christ and his teachings can speak to an idealism that has nothing to do with belief in God or the church, and has everything to do rather with this belief of this higher idealism, which of course perfectly describes the early Bolsheviks. These are people who are going to build the New Jerusalem. These are fanatic believers, as it were. So we have revolutionaries who are being executed for attempted assassinations and assassinations. And what are they doing? They are actually affirming that it's Jesus Christ that helped get them where they are. This Andrei Zhilyabov, who was put on trial in 1881 for helping to organize the assassination of Alexander II, said in his defense, "I deny orthodoxy, though I affirm the essence of the teachings of Jesus Christ. The essence of his teaching was my primary moral incentive." So when you're talking about imaging Christ, especially in the Russian context, you can't just talk about it in a religious sense or in the sense of something to do with believers. You can be sure that the young atheist Bolsheviks were true believers, but they believed in this other ideal. It was a perfectly human ideal that we have it in our hands, human beings, without God, to bring the ideals of great moral teachers like Jesus Christ, who was a man and not a God, into reality. And what Bogdanov and Lunacharsky did with the God-building movement was simply to capitalize on the atmosphere of the Silver Age, this quasi-religious atmosphere, building sense of an apocalypse, to say this is the meaningful moment, this is the belief system that makes sense now. And if there's anything mystical about it, it has to do with the fact that it is human beings that are the source and summit of all greatness in the world. And that's a little bit about God building. In fact, though it was discredited rather quickly in the early in the 1920s, it certainly emerges in the cult of the personality that is attaches itself to Stalin, and really sort of permeates all of Soviet culture with its attempt to overlay on top of religious holidays Soviet ones, and to create Soviet saints, and to create a whole new sacred language. So the God builders feed right into this tendency in Soviet culture.
So on the subject of Bulgakov, then, if that's the case, and what's so dangerous about Bulgakov being prohibited from writing? Is there something about his, or publishing, I guess, not writing, but is there something that about what's in The Master and Margarita that's so profoundly dangerous to the Soviet project?
Well, the thing about The Master and Margarita is by the time he's writing it, he has had a very rough spell in the young Soviet theater world, where he had early successes with his plays, but because he is a satirist, and because satire is a dangerous thing, especially in a state looking for complete orthodoxy and complete belief in the order of things, he starts to have a hard time getting his plays on the stage. He's finding it a hard time even becoming employed. He actually writes Stalin a letter saying, "Please let me leave the Soviet Union." When Stalin writes back, offering him, "Well, do you really want to leave Russia? If I gave you a post in a different theater, would you take that instead?" He ends up staying, encountering the same kinds of problems eventually. But it's really not that Bulgakov so much is trying to get this novel published in Soviet times, because he doesn't finish until shortly before his death. And there was no attempt to publish it until the 1960s, 1966, 67 is when it comes out in a slightly truncated form. It's just that by then he's been discredited. And what he's also seen when he looks around him is that that the what's replaced the traditional ideas of morality is something that is so steeped in politics as to be dangerous and suspect. So he's trying to go back and image Christ as a way of, I think, reanimating our understanding of maybe the true source and summit of morality. He has a formative moment in the 1920s as he's looking through a stack of these of Bezbožnik. This is an anti-religious magazine that's being published in the 1920s, and it contains all sorts of harsh satires and cartoons about, of course, religion and the church and priests and so on. But also, there are these incredible sort of slanderous takes on Christ himself, and he says, "This is beyond the pale. Say what you want about the church and belief, but leave Christ alone." And I think that's where he gets this idea of, okay, I'm going to have this novel where the devil comes to Moscow for his spring ball, and he's going to encounter in this course of events a writer who's written a novel on Christ and tried to publish it in Soviet times, only to be persecuted like me. And in this dialectic, we'll find what emerges about higher truths.
So I'm looking at the time here. I'd like to talk to you for another hour about Bulgakov because, well, he's so great. But maybe on the subject of Dr. Zhivago, then, you said that the main character is, in a sense, both fully human and fully divine. I was wondering if you could explain, like, how is that the case? How is that character Christ-like in the sense of both being all too human and also divine at the same time?
Well, so Yuri Zhivago is not divine, but he paradoxically affirms a very traditional Christology in poems that are published after or left after his death, some of which are published. Certainly they're all in the novel Dr. Zhivago, about some 25 poems, and about, I think, 9 of them are on Christ and Christian themes. And there's some mixed poems too, where Christian themes appear in other contexts. What is interesting is what Pasternak is doing with this dialectic. We have very traditional biblical Christ in the poems, and a lot of the events from Christ's life duly depicted there. Yuri Zhivago himself, whose name and whose Zhivago, the Living One, evokes language from the Bible reserved for Christ. Who has many attributes that put him into a Christological light, who works at the elevation of the Christ Hospital, who is this person who kind of goes through a private Golgotha, private passion. What Pasternak does is he takes this character and he says, "I'm going to see if I can distort or estrange the traditional Christ of these poems by giving us a Christ figure, Yuri, who evokes Christ, but he's also a guy who has 2 extramarital affairs and produces 3 extramarital children. And I'm going to leave it to the readers to say, how can a Christ figure be a philanderer and someone who doesn't believe in the resurrection of the body?" This is something he pronounces in the novel, and so on and so forth. And I'm going to let these two things come into collision: the poet and his poetry, and in this collision, see what is revealed about Christ, about what Christ must be.
Do you think that? Thinking about the last part of your book where you're discussing more contemporary authors, I was curious if you think that people who are given images of Christ in more recent Russian literature, do you think that the context they're writing in more resembles the context in which Bulgakov and Pasternak were writing, or the context that Dostoevsky and Tolstoy were writing in?
Well, the post-Soviet period in particular is one in which there's been a public resurgence in professed belief or professed adherence to Russian Orthodoxy. Now, of course, church going in Russia is about 7% of the population, so no one's going to church, but some 71, 72% identify themselves as Orthodox Christians. So writing about Christian themes now or on Christian themes, perfectly non-problematical. In fact, it can even be said to be pro-state, because the state has, as in the old imperial days, has sort of become a great, or the church has become a great ally of the state again, and compromised itself in some people's eyes in doing so. The Soviet period, though, the 1960s, when we have people like Yerofeyev writing, or let's say Dombrovsky in his novel, The Faculty of Useless Things, they're writing novels that will never be able to be published because they're explicitly about Christ in Soviet times. That's more like the era of that Bulgakov is writing in, or Pasternak is writing in. When you unless through some extraordinary intervention, are not going to see these things be published. But now you can publish, but ironically, no one's writing a Christ novel anymore. No one's writing, I've yet to see a novel with a sustained Christ narrative along the lines of the four case studies in my book.
What about, I just happened to read Votulazkin's novel, Loris. That seemed to kind of carry forward some of the holy fool themes from like The Idiot or something like that. Is that something you're familiar with? Or?
Well, very much. You could make a case for that. I didn't bring in, I didn't attempt any analysis of the most recent writing because I was trying to, frankly, because my publisher was keeping me limited in how many words I could keep in this book. Yeah. I actually cut 100 pages and 30,000 words out of this book to get it into covers. So, wow. But one could say that you could, and this is something I would be more interested in doing. You could look at Votulazkin's book as the most likely subject of serious extended Christ imaging that we have today. Still not quite on the scale of my forced case studies, but the closest thing I would say that we have today.
Yeah, since I just read it, it's kind of been on my mind. It's my current obsession, I guess. Maybe since we're about out of time here, I want to lay a big one on you, and that is if somebody was thinking about really kind of taking a dive into the Russian literary tradition, what would you recommend that they start with first? I know I could riff on that subject for days, but what do you think about that question?
Well, you'd have to. I think the best compromise answer to that would be to say, okay, you'd have to pick one from each of the two great centuries. So for instance, for 20th century, you want to get someone hooked on Russian literature, you get them Master Margarita. I have not had a single student who's picked up that book who has not been totally enchanted with the whole matrix of the novel and its concerns with belief, with romance, with politics, with prohibitions, cultural prohibitions, so on and so forth. That would be the one for sure. It's a gift. So if they don't want to read something today, to give them Master Margarita, you go to the 19th century. I'm going to have to pick something from Dostoevsky because he's the most provocative. It can't be Brothers Karamazov because it's too demanding. So what you give them is something like Notes from Underground that will totally blow them away, especially when you understand that what the underground man's trying to get at is the need for Christ, although he never says it. In fact, when Dostoevsky tries to say it in chapter 10 of part 1, it gets censored out because they think he's making fun of Christ. the need for Christ that suddenly emerges in the underground man. What's the underground man talking about? He's talking about the same thing that we encounter here. He's talking about the materialists who tell us, hey, I'm sorry, you thought you had an eternal soul. You don't. You're just matter. And when you die, you're going to go into nothingness. It's like Stephen Hawking, who said, the afterlife is a fairy tale for people who are afraid of the dark. Well, when a man like Stephen Hawking, who sits around all day thinking, says something like that, you go, oh my God, I guess that's true. We're doomed. This is all we got. But you got to be like the underground man and say, well, let's push back against that concept a little bit and see what we can make of it. So I'd say give them the notes from the underground and let them go with the underground man and his rebellion against anything that constrains us as human beings.
Well, let's see. I'll have to think about that. I've wondered that many times as people have asked me what they should read. So I will take those suggestions with all due consideration.
It has the virtue of being short.
Yeah. So thanks for being with us, John. That was quite an interesting book. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me about it.
I'm very grateful. Thank you for this opportunity to share with you my thoughts.
Okay. Bye.